Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
And before we do anything today, it's February 11th, 2016, and we need to wish a happy birthday to Paul Bocuse. It's his 90th birthday today. So I know there's a big celebration going on in Lyon, and we hope everybody's having a great time over there. Here in Bushwick, Brooklyn, we're going to devote a good piece of the show to a piece that ran last week on the website First We Feast. Chris Schoenberger and Justin Bolus wrote a piece called "The Problems with Food Media That Nobody Wants to Talk About." Got a fair bit of attention on social media, fairly instantaneously as these things go. The piece outlined 9 issues in food media, many of which intersect with our focus on chefs here on The Front Burner. So we wanted to get in on that. And Jimmy, I know last week you had indicated a little bit of trepidation about, you know, what seemed like not just a third rail topic, but maybe almost 10 third rail topics kind of bunched together. So you've had a week. Are you ready to get in on this?
Yes, sir. However, I guess I was thinking that maybe we'll let you and the writers in the room, seeing as Marco and I are the chefs in the room today, maybe you and the writers kick this off and we jump in.
Okay, we'll do that. Well, first of all, let's introduce our guests. I'm delighted to say we have Chris Schoenberger, who is the editor-in-chief and co-founder of First We Feast and co-author of the piece here in the studio. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
We have Max Falkowitz, who's the senior digital editor of Savour and formerly was at the website Serious Eats.
Good to be here.
And Chef Marco Canora of Hearth, 50 Paces in Brodo here in New York City. Hi, Marco.
Hello. Happy to be here.
So I'd love to first, Chris, just start by talking to you about this story, you know, because as a writer and as someone who has a blog and has various social media accounts, there are things that instantly came to mind for me when this ran. I think probably a lot of writers have fantasized about writing some version of this piece themselves. And when I tweeted out the link to the piece, I simply wrote on it, "The Things We Think and Do Not Say," which was a reference to the title of the mission statement that Jerry Maguire wrote in the movie Jerry Maguire. And the thing about that mission statement to me was, you know, it's in the movie, he stays up all night in a hotel room, he has this moment of conscience, he writes this thing, he prints a million copies of it, he distributes it, and then instantly has buyer's remorse. He comes down in the lobby in the next scene, and he's very kind of sheepishly coming through the lobby, and everyone's applauding. But then behind his back, you see these two guys in the corner saying, "How long do you give them?" And, you know, the other guy says, "About a month," you know, which is sort of the hypocrisy of the applause, right? So I just on a human level, when you wrote this thing and as you and Justin were writing it and you're sitting there and you hit publish or whatever it says on your programming software and it goes live, what was the feeling you guys had? Were you bracing yourselves for some kind of storm coming back your way? Was it this big unknown? Just what were sort of the feelings going into this piece?
Yeah, it was a little bit of a big unknown. To be honest, I kind of thought about the piece and writing the piece maybe 5 months ago and sat on it forever because it was a soul-searching exercise for me. It kind of came out of this existential, what is media today? What are the challenges? How can we take the real business challenges of media and do better? So about 2 years ago, we wrote a piece that was about the problems in food, and that was looking outward and looking at, you know, why do people think ethnic cuisine should be cheap? What's the deal with tipping? And sort of just put those things out there, and it kicked off a great discussion. So more and more, I thought, well, all of these conversations I'm having with my cohorts in food media have a little bit of a negative tinge to them. and why do we never have a forum in which we can talk about it?
Right.
So I was a little scared that I would put it out there, and just in terms of my peers, it would be like, why are you such a miserable asshole? Like,
right.
Why don't you just get out of the industry? But what I thought was interesting was almost all of the feedback was, hey, this resonates a lot with me, and I'm glad that someone said it.
Yeah, it's interesting because there have been, I mean, one of the things that would fuel my own anxiety if I wrote a piece like that was there have been some things in the not too distant past. It was almost a week exactly, maybe a year and a week since Mark Vetri wrote a Huffington Post piece that, you know, pretty much caused a lot of writers' heads to explode on Twitter. Some similar points in the piece, but also not exactly the same piece. Also coming from a chef rather than a writer, which kind of crosses, I think, a fence that a lot of people perceive. And even, you know, Pete Wells, when he reviewed Bruno Pizza and talked about sort of the hype that surrounds new restaurants, and, you know, he went in there to try, there was a bread course that had been written about it on, I think on Grub Street maybe, and it wasn't even available, and he was talking about this whole machine that sort of happens, and even he caught a lot of flack from certain circles. So I would think it is interesting, and I was struck that the response to your piece was very, you had a couple of conversations going on Twitter with, you know, John Birdsall jumped in, and Pete Wells wrote something supportive, and Kat Kinsman, Charlotte Druckman. I mean, a lot of, you know, some of the thinkers out there really seemed to connect with it.
Yeah, and that was interesting. And, you know, another funny thing was that people coming into that Twitter conversation also immediately said, this conversation is exactly what's wrong with food media, because no one's criticizing the piece criticizing food media, and everyone wants to, you know, pat the writers on the back, which isn't what we were looking for. But I think that discussion was great, and I think with the Vetri piece, yeah, there's a total different dialectic at play when you have someone on the other side of the fence saying it. So there was some defensiveness. And also what I hoped we could do by talking about it from the inside was really speak about it from a point of view of the people who are actually creating it. And I think that hopefully came across to people through the way that it was written, and, you know, trying to be even-handed and also self-reflective, as opposed to, well, the rest of the landscape is the problem, not us.
Yeah, I saw that some people kind of said, well, you know, maybe you should start looking at yourself. You said on Twitter, you know, we're not inoculating ourselves against some of these some of the things we're actually saying here.
Absolutely. And, yeah, you know, that was sort of the stance of the piece, to be reflective about those things. And, you know, with the Pete Wells thing, an interesting debate that came out of his review was people saying, well, the New York Times has FloFab talking about things before they come out, and, you know, the New York Times does 8 million profile pieces on Danny Bowen. So a nuance that was maybe lost in our piece and in his piece is that even within one media organization, you have different forms of journalism. And I think what we're seeing is a difficulty of parsing out those things. What is the reporting? What is the reviewing? What is the profiling? And it's all becoming this mishmash where the critique is the hype, is the reporting, and people are confused.
Right. You don't have the same kind of distinction you might have, say, in a traditional newspaper between editorial, the editorial content and or the news content and the editorial page, for example, where that's a very clear kind of church and state division. I guess I'll just touch on some of the things that were in the piece, and we'll get into some of these in a little more detail in a minute, but this sort of overall contention that the food media has gone, for lack of a better word, a little bit soft. People are afraid to criticize chefs for fear of losing access. That people only seem comfortable tearing down industry idols when it's been made safe by somebody who's gone before them. A lack of diversity. That PR has too much influence, and it goes on, and we'll get into that in a minute. Max, I would just love to get just from you as somebody, you know, in the business, on the writing editorial side, what were sort of your just general reaction to the piece, and what were you hearing, without naming names, obviously, but what was sort of the gist of what, if your life is anything like mine, I got texts that day, I got emails that day, I had a couple of conversations in the 2 or 3 days after, just sort of how did this land on your radar and your peer group?
Well, I don't have as poetic a story of how I tweeted out the story. I just wrote, yep, And that was pretty much the response of this is what's here, and this is something that I think that most people in media recognize to varying degrees from different outlets, and it's something that I think readers pick up on more than media people like to think that they do. But it was just thrilling, honestly, genuinely thrilling to see someone speaking about it in such an honest and reflective way. And I thought the way Chris and Justin wrote the story, it was so gracious and reflective, and that all of the examples that they picked up, they used of the sons that they were talking about were from the First Beef Feast website, I thought was wonderful. And it wasn't a piece scolding anyone for doing what they do. It was saying we all have a moral responsibility and an intellectual responsibility to do this better. So I was watching the same circle of privileged writers and food people talking about the story on Twitter that you and Chris were. And I think the big problem isn't that people weren't criticizing the piece or being critical of the piece, or that First Beef Feast wasn't being critical of themselves, because I think they certainly were. I think the big problem is that we read it, and then the question is, what's the call to action? And what are we actually going to do about it? And,
yeah. So this was going to come up, but what, I mean, and maybe for the two of you, but what is the call to action? And what is, you know, I guess what goes hand in hand with that question is, you know, there are, for some of these, when people talk about things like quote unquote clickbait, you know, and lists and slideshow, you know, these things that people, a lot of people point to, and even sort of how quickly some things get written in the name of generating a lot of content. I mean, there are commercial reasons that you guys could speak to much better than me, but there are reasons that some of these dynamics exist, which have to do with just making a site financially viable and drawing the number of people you need to be there. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that was one thing that I think readers in general jump on for media across the board. Clickbait, you know, just the churn and burn of blog culture. And that was something that I didn't want to touch on in the piece, because it's not necessarily, to me, one of the problems of how things are covered. It may be a feedback loop. It may, you know, bring the wrong stories to the surface sometimes, and that's something that media at large is struggling with.
Right.
But I think people put types of content into boxes and say, oh, you did a list, so, you know, that's lower on the echelon of where good content could be. Some of the best pieces I've ever read are lists. So for me, on that point, the call to action is take what it is that you're doing and raise the bar on it. So we got into how people put together their lists of best of restaurants.
Yeah, that was very funny.
The huge problem that we have now is...
And basically, just for people who haven't read the piece, you kind of indicated that a lot of these lists are the 12 best of a certain type of dish, that basically a lot of these things aren't generated by sort of good old shoe leather reporting, actually tasting all these things, but that a lot of this is the result of some, you know, very earnest Googling around. Mm-hmm. And you even said, like, bonus points if you go past the fifth page of Google results. And your belief is that readers can tell when things are put together that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we said in the piece, a lot of those lists have just become sort of like the town common, where everyone can come and have the same debate over what's the best pizza. Like, they know that your list is not well researched, and they can smell that from a mile away. But, you know, I haven't been in this industry for decades, so a lot of other people can speak more to, you know, what was great about the gourmet era and what was not good about it, and what's better now. But one thing that I've seen even in my 5 years or so change is that, because when I was at Time Out and we were working on print schedules, if we were going to do 10 best burgers in New York, you know, we were eating 50 burgers and pounding the pavement because we had the time and we had the resources. Now it's like you need to do 5 of those lists a week, and you don't have enough money to underwrite the writer to go out and do the research, and suddenly you're in a situation where people are saying, well, I had that burger 3 years ago, it was good, and right, it's on the list. And that's a problem, I think. And again, as we mentioned in the piece, very different from other forms of media that have a list-based, you know, culture of writing. But if you're a music writer, you can listen to all the music at your computer.
Right.
You can't eat all the food at your computer.
Right. Not yet.
Not yet. We'll get there.
Jimmy, do you want to get in, bring the chefs in on this conversation?
Yeah, thank you, Andrew. Pardon me. I guess one of the points that came up from Chris and Justin's piece is the PR influence. I want to get with you on this for a second, Marco. I guess PR influence, mm-hmm. Are public relations too influential in this process right now as it is? And, you know, I guess my thought is perhaps it is true. And, sure. You know, really just to drive the traffic in the door initially. But that certainly doesn't get you a good review, right? And, you know, the real judgment is in our execution. And so it kind of goes back to us to really perform on a high level to get where we want to go. And I don't know if you use public relations, so I just wanted to have you speak to this point.
Sure. We do use PR, but I'd like to go back for a minute about the piece and say, you know, I think it's not just food journalism. I think it's all journalism across every industry. Mm-hmm. I think it's a product of how we teach our children today that there's no losers, right? It's like nobody could lose at a game anymore, and everybody's got to get a trophy. And our skin is becoming very, very thin, and everybody's very fearful of being honest and critical. And even early on in your piece, Chris, you know, you were like, this is not a diss song. This is a real song, right? You made that reference. And it's kind of like everybody's really afraid to be critical. And I think that that's the bigger underlying problem, right? And I think that losing and hearing tough criticism is what drives people to do well and be ambitious and create good content or create good food or do whatever you do better. Like, you need to get beat up a little bit. And I think this whole notion of we're soft is really the underlying problem. Like, I think we're all soft in every level, you know?
Well, I would actually, and I would add to what you're saying. To me, you know, we had a piece a couple weeks ago on it was occasioned by the Per Se Review, and we had chefs and critics talking that week, and we didn't quite get to this point, but I think there's a fine line, and I think a lot of people don't perceive it anymore, between criticism and derision. So I think you can be critical of something. And I think what made a lot of chefs angry, let's say, about that review is like the three kind of zingers in that review, right? And that's where people feel like, oh, a line was crossed.
You didn't
like,
need to go there.
Like, yeah. You can say you can say a restaurant has gotten less good without making a joke at their expense, right? And I feel like this is the thing. I think it's to your point. I think, yeah, to be critical can be constructive.
Correct.
That's a term that's existed forever, constructive criticism.
Yeah, and welcomed.
And it should be, I think, welcome. When you start becoming derisive or cruel about it, yeah. Or just a jerk about it, I think people can't hear it. You can't hear through that. That creates static, right? But by the same token, I think for some people, all criticism is taken in as derision. Like, they can't, mm-hmm. To your point, Marco, I think they...
So sensitive.
Yeah.
Everyone's so sensitive.
Yeah.
And I think that's why people got more sensitive about Vetri's piece, because there was an immediate, you know, journalists and media, especially food media, don't get critiqued. We don't get reviewed. And maybe we should get talked to more. I mean, obviously, comment sections will let you know. Twitter will let you know. But, you know, people will say, well, we're doing good traffic. And all my friends on Twitter said that my piece was great. But I think people could do with taking a tougher look, and also, to your point, having thicker skin and being mm-hmm. willing to hear when things are not
right.
That great.
Yeah, sometimes you lose, and sometimes your food stinks, and you need to be told. But, you know, to your point about PR, right? You know, it's definitely part of the game, and we all, you know, not all of us can afford it. And I think, you know, I feel fortunate and lucky enough that we have a restaurant that I could afford to pay the big nut of PR. And, you know, a lot of this is, it's just the way the game is played. And if you kind of don't want to be in it, you shouldn't kind of play it. And I like to look at parallels for me as a chef, you know. The clickbait that you speak of, the listicles and whatever, it's kind of, Jimmy and I are faced with the same thing, right? It's like the chicken liver pate appetizer. and it's the roasted chicken entree. And, you know, there is this underlying viability of what we're doing and what works and what doesn't work. It's like I've been trying to put squab on the menu for 20 years. And every year or two, I try it again because I have this hope that people are going to buy squab. And at a certain point, I gave up and I'm not putting squab on my menu anymore. And I think that a lot of food writers, especially the old guard, kind of feel the same way. And a lot of them are giving up. You know, like we referred to Bittman kind of leaving the game. And I think there's a lot of frustration out there. And I think amongst writers, you write an insightful, beautiful piece and people don't get past paragraph one. And it's discouraging. You know, I'm discouraged that I had to put a Tuscan fried chicken on my menu. But we're all trying to make a living, and we all have metrics that we look at. And eyeballs is the food media metric. And, you know, you have to do what works. And if you don't do what works, then your blog goes offline and you're not heard of anymore.
Yeah.
And if I can speak to that point.
Yes, Max.
About, I mean, it's yeah, we have our avocado toast and our chicken liver pâtés in food media all right. the time. And we have our metrics and we have our analytics engines and we pay attention to them closely. But I think the big mistake that a lot of people in media hold on to is that those metrics are the only things that matter. And that just because if you put a listicle that's 10 best burgers in wherever city, of course people are going to read it because that's what the content of it is. That doesn't mean, though, that traffic that you get from that is equally valuable to traffic that you're getting from other more insightful stories, stories that might not burst the same way they do, get you that traffic spike the same way that those initial articles do, but they have more long-term traffic, they build a sense of credibility for you, they give you a reputation as a type of place that does these types of stories. And I think the big mistake that a lot of editors make is that they're, and that a lot of writers make is that they aren't considering that all traffic isn't equal and that all eyeballs aren't equal. And if you, we fortunately don't have to deal with food cost in terms of a lot of these, you know, like they're essentially limitless what we're capable of producing. And the beauty of writing for the internet in particular is that there's an audience out there for pretty much everything that you want to cut. Everything that you want to cover, and there's someone who wants to read your thing. And maybe your big, well-researched story that you've spent months reporting and you've been talking to the right people didn't make the splash that you wanted it to. That shouldn't discourage you from doing that type of reporting and that type of storytelling. That should make you wonder, okay, why didn't this make the splash that it did? What can we do to make it better? And often that's not a problem of the reporting itself, it's the problem of how you delivered it, maybe. You didn't reach the right people, it wasn't photographed the right way, the headlines didn't reach the right people in a compelling way. And I think people get so easily discouraged by that tough, difficult writing because it doesn't always make a big splash, and you put all this effort into it, and then it's gone, and then you have to do another listicle to meet your traffic quota for the week. But
do you actually talk about these things in the way you're talking about this right now? Like internally, meeting traffic quota for the week, the balance of sort of the listicle and the long form pieces. Are these conversations that you all, and I guess for both of you guys, but Max, starting with you, are these conversations that you all get around a table and actually talk about in these terms that you're describing them right now?
I've been pretty lucky both at Serious Eats and at Sever, where traffic matters. It's obviously important, and we're obviously trying to grow our audience, but it's never been a life or death. You need to meet this certain amount of numbers or we're shutting off your website and firing you. So I have to recognize that I'm sort of privileged in being able not having to hold to that the way
right.
that some other outlets might have to. But the big question for me is not how can we get the most attention this week. It's what's going to be the most valuable content we can produce this week. And then value takes a lot of different forms. And value can be a great recipe that's been rigorously tested or what have you. It can be a story that's trying to tell a story that no one's ever told before. It can be a really well-made list that's just making good, serviceable points that no one's really made before.
Sure.
When I look at the publication schedule for the week, and I'm thinking, okay, like what are we actually doing this week, and what are we really doing, and what am I most excited about? There's absolutely a balance of what's going to get us traffic and what's going to be meaty things, but those really shouldn't be two diametric opposites. They you should be considering your content. What I think we try to do internally, what I hear a lot of writer friends try to do is don't think of it in terms of, oh, I have to do this clickbaity piece to then fuel this passion project. It's how can we make this passion project actually work? And why are we acting in a really self-defeating way to say that these in-depth, rewarding pieces aren't going to get us anywhere? They are. Like, if you do good work, people will go read it. And if you deliver it in the right way, people will find it.
Right.
And that's, like, the real challenge, like, that. Yeah, that's hard. And that it doesn't always work. And you do one amazing story, and you have to do nine others that don't always meet the mark.
But sure.
That's worth getting into it.
We're talking with Max Falkowitz, Chris Schoenberger, and Chef Marco Canora. We're going to take a break in just a moment. We do want to just let everyone know we now have a Twitter handle devoted to this show. It's at Chef Podcast, which miraculously was available. I don't know how, but it's at Chef Podcast. We also have a Facebook page. You just look up The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew and like us over there. And please, if you do listen to the show on iTunes, we would really appreciate a review. We have one review. We've got a lot of great emails from people. We have one review. We want more reviews. And in honor of the topic of this show, you can be critical if you need to be. They don't have to be five stars, but we'd love some more reviews. With that, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to pick up the conversation here on food media when The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew returns.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We're talking about food media with Chris Schoenberger from First We Feast, Max Falkowitz from Savour, and Chef Marco Canora. Jimmy, why don't we pick this up with continuing along our chef thread here. Why don't you and Marco keep going?
Thank you, Andrew. Yeah, one of the First We Feast points was the pre-reviews or the hype. Is it hyper or actual, you know, critique? And, you know, I guess one of my thoughts on that is, you know, if you're open, you should be ready, right? Mm-hmm. Ready to be judged. In other words, if you put something out there, you have no choice but to be ready to accept what comes back to you, right? And so I guess, Marco, my thought is, you know, would you agree that any restaurant opens in peak condition? And, you know, do your guests actually influence what you do?
Right.
You know, through the experience.
You know, it's a compelling argument, and I've heard it a lot. You know, if you're going to charge me full price, then you have to be ready and you have to be performing at a certain level that you're open and ready to get criticism. You know, running restaurants is like 100 balls in the air at once, and when you first open, there's no way, even if you are charging, that you're going to be at your best. So I think, you know, to go on day one and to write criticism, I think, is a real disservice to not only the customers, but also the operators. And I think anybody, and I think you got to give them time to get their legs. So, you know, I'm not a fan of, as soon as you're open, you open yourself to criticism. There has to be a level of understanding that this is a long-term game plan. You know, you got a 10-year lease, you got a bunch of new people in a new space with new equipment and new menus, and it is incredibly challenging, and I think it's incredibly unfair to go there and start putting things in print and being critical. I think you have to give them some time to get their legs. I don't care how good you are or how many restaurants you've opened, it takes time, and I think there should be an acknowledgement of that.
You know, it's funny. We had we did the show a couple of weeks, episode 4 of this season, Chefs and Critics, and Sam Sifton very simply said, you know, chefs need to realize that we're in a different business than they are, which I thought was a great point. By the same token, and he didn't take it this far, I'm just saying, because they don't really do this, but, you know, to me, anyone who writes about restaurants knows what you two are just talking about, which is that a restaurant takes time. You have to be open. You have to see what happens when actual customers come in. You know, if we're all sort of after the same thing, which is the best places to eat and the best result out, you know, and giving customers the best information, you know, talking about something the minute it opens is really not going to be an accurate reflection of the long term. It's probably going to be a significantly better restaurant two weeks later, a month later, and then 6 months later, forget it. It's going to be on a whole nother level. And that's almost anybody, even the most experienced operators. But I think everybody knows that,
right,
on both sides of the fence.
You know, on the same token, there's the problem of people being something they in the beginning to get the review, right? Like so many restaurants overstaff like crazy, get the guy to do all the spotting, and they perform at a level early on that they're not performing in 12 or 16 or 18 months later when the reviews are behind them, right? And that's kind of the flip side of the problem.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thing. Chris, you look like you have something to say.
Yeah, I think Margo summed it up really well. Sort of, I think there's two sides to this that make a lot of sense. Like, a restaurant does need a little time to find its feet. On the flip side, it's open, it's charging full price. People should be able to talk about it. I think to get more granular, for me in media, what I find disingenuous is that people are reviewing on the first day the same place that they've been hyping for months. So they've created the hype that they then are going to go and add more to or tear down, which I find very strange. And then, you know, with the stuff that Pete Wells was referencing with his Pruno review, it's like, is this a review when it's a first look at something that no one's seen before? No, it's really an opening report where the reporters had access, and they're sort of couching this review as something that's extremely new and exciting and great, which is all well and good, but to kind of do it in the format of a review blurs the line way too much for readers.
Yeah.
Right. And I guess there's some tools that we've seen used, we brought up not charging full price, or, you know, maybe 20% off for the first month or 2 months we're open, or you know, perhaps writing a preview menu on top of the menu. So it's twofold, you know, it's to the writers and it's to Marco. You know, Marco, have you used these tools? And then, you know, to the press, do these tools mean anything to you?
The whole notion of friends and family, you know, it's like you do this friends and family to get that out of the way, right? So you invite people in for the first two nights and you kind of work the kinks out concept. I don't think that ever really works. You know, it's better than opening to the public on the first night. You have to do that. But, you know, the economics behind this whole conversation has to be mentioned, right? It's like, I can't afford to do a week of friends and family, and I can't afford to do 20% off when I open. I'm already over budget, right? I've already been squeezed by a million people. And, you know, there's economics that are just realities that, you know, we need to start getting income. So I'm sorry, but I can't give you a 20% discount because we're working out our kinks.
Sure. And what about, you know, we've seen other operators write, you know, preview menu on top of their menu, suggesting to the press, I think more so than to their guests, like, hey, when we take the preview off the menu, we're ready to, that's what we really, how we really want to be, and we're ready to be judged now. Is there any weight in there anymore?
I mean, that's kind of a theater model, right?
Previews, I guess, and so.
Critics aren't supposed to go in and, you know, I don't
know. Well, there's suggestions that, you know, the operator, the owner, the producer might make to say, hey, we're not ready, even though we are open. You know, maybe we're not charging full price. Maybe the preview suggests that we're working out our kinks and things like that.
Yeah, I guess my take is I don't think it's on the operators to deal with how we write about these places.
Sure.
To be completely honest.
So once you're open, get ready for whatever comes back.
That, and then on the media side, we should think about whether we're doing this in an honest way that's good service journalism or sort of coming at it from a critical standpoint that makes sense. And I think we've reached a point where we're confused and the readers are confused.
Got it. And so one last point on this. If the preview is written on it, but it's not suggesting we're ready yet, or in your opinion, you should be ready because you're open, and we're still trying to work out our kinks. My belief is that no business the day it opens is truly ready to be as great as they can be. And in that sense, are there things that we would do to suggest to you that we're not ready? Or is it just once you're open, you need to be ready?
I mean, I think Chang did that with Nishi, which is a perfect example of a restaurant that has a huge amount of pre-opening talk. And he's out there saying, this isn't the menu that anyone's going to see day one. And that sort of worked into the pre-review and just kind of compounding the confusion for everyone. So you go into the comment sections of pieces about that restaurant, and it's just readers saying, you know, they're really angry at how much it's being hyped. You have, like, Ben Leventhal, the founder of Eater, going into the comments, you know, talking to the reporters of Eater saying, you know, what service are you doing? And so that's an interesting conversation, and it's cool that it's happening out loud for everyone to see, but I think it just speaks to the fact that people are not drawing lines that readers can understand about what the purpose of this hype critique reporting is.
Right.
Got it.
And then, I wonder if the answer to what media should be doing and how we should be more responsibly reporting on these restaurants is that, I mean, I find it interesting, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts, Jimmy and Marco, about, like, what does it mean for a restaurant to be, quote, ready? And at what point does, it's not like after 2 months, suddenly a restaurant goes from total chaos to it's now ready and firing on all cylinders. I mean, I assume these things evolve constantly, and sometimes a restaurant might not be ready until it reads a review from a critic and says, okay, well, these are the things that we need to change. And that critic might not file maybe even for 6 months. But the question to me as an editor is what should we be telling readers about that? And I think this is a trajectory that food people understand, but the general public might not. And maybe the answer is, why are we writing hype stories about these restaurants at all? Are we so starved for things to write about that we need to cover restaurants a very small select group of restaurants so aggressively, or could we cover other things until they have a little more time to get their work together?
Just before these guys jump in, I'll just say one thing about, I feel like you used to see much more in reviews. I'm talking a long time ago. This notion of they're young, it'll probably get better. You know, they're young. What we're all talking about, I think, used to get built into reviews in a way it doesn't anymore. I think that used to be something that was commented on by the critic when the place got their first reviews. But go ahead, guys.
Right. So to Marco, you know, you write a menu, you open a restaurant, right?
Yep.
Here we go. We're live. Here we go. These are our best intentions. And then, you know, 3 months later, 6 months later, 1 year later, I'm pretty sure, you know, in your kitchen, in my kitchen, the menu's totally different than the opening menu. And what part of this growth that we're experiencing in our first year, you know, intellectually and what we share with our guests is driven by the guests and the guest reaction to the food? You know, Max brings up the press reaction to the food and getting a review, and maybe that, you know, helps direct your focus. Mm-hmm. But, you know, really, if no restaurant is perfect day one, you know, what's the growth like, and where do the customer feedback fit into the growth?
Right. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, Yelp reviews and Open Table reviews and how people don't read them. And I've never been on that side of the fence. Like, I read them all the time, and I think that there's value in metadata, so that if you go to Open Table and there's 3,000 reviews there, like, I think there's probably something in there that you could get value from. But I think this notion of people being afraid to be critical, it happens the most in your own dining room when people are there. So as much as I'd like to, like, feed off of customer feedback in the dining room, I have I'm ashamed to say I have a very jaded view of that, because I don't really trust, you know, it was great. It was great. I mean, I'm guilty of it myself. I'm not going to engage with a chef who comes out into the dining room or a server who asks me how it was. I'm not going to start, you know, going on about what I really critically thought of the meal, because frankly, I want to be hanging out with the people I'm there with, and it's not the time or the place. So, but Max, to your point of what does it mean to be ready, I think that there's so many balls in the air, and there's so many things that could change on a daily basis in, like, the highly dynamic world of restaurants, that you're never ready, and things are always changing, and you're always short a guy, or you always have a new guy on garmage, or a new guy on pasta, and you're always training people, and it's one of the biggest challenges about running a restaurant. So from a food media perspective or a food critic perspective, I think what's really important is to go over a span of time and have many experiences and then draw conclusions on those experiences, because the game is too dynamic to go and take one picture of it and then draw criticism from it. And I think that any good food journalist or any good critic out there is going to go at least 3 times or 4 times, and ideally over a span of time, because so many of us are cooking seasonally, and it's almost a disservice to review a restaurant in a place like the New York Times without seeing kind of a broader scope of what the chef is capable of in terms of seasonal cooking.
We're going to move on in a second, but the one thing I guess I think that's kind of between the lines of what we're all saying is, and I'll take this back to Jerry Maguire. I started with Jerry Maguire, is customers complete the restaurant. You know, you can only prepare so much until you're actually open and have customers there. It's a living... Jimmy and I talk about this every week when we prepare for the show.
Yeah, it gets a little lonely cooking for yourself.
Well, there's that, but we have all these notes every week for the show, and then we always have to go, well, you know, there are going to be 3 guests here actually responding to what we're doing, and it's going to have a lot. So I think until you actually have customers moving through the experience of a meal in a restaurant, the restaurant simply can't be what... You can't totally calibrate it until that happens. And I understand people are paying full freight when they come in this first week or two, but I just think it's the nature of a restaurant that until customers are flowing through an evening there, and the chef, the owner, the managers, the you know, the beverage director, all those people can see what that dynamic, to use Marco's word, is like, the restaurant can't be fully calibrated. It's something you can't do without those customers coming in. Anyway, I do want to touch, and it does kind of relate to this, but you know, Leslie Brenner at the Dallas Morning News just recently started this new series. It's called Off the Menu. It's a video interview series in which she sits face to face with chefs that she does a full feature starred review. I definitely have my own thoughts on this, but just we're getting toward the last 10 minutes or so of the show. But I just love a quick thought. How does this strike people as kind of a natural evolution of this world that we all live in? Does it seem like kind of an outlier? You know, a lot of chefs have dropped critics have dropped their anonymity if they had it, but they, you know, they've stopped pretending they had it in recent years. There have obviously been some chef critic dust ups that have mostly happened through social media. But Chris, what's your quick thought on this?
I guess I'm of two minds. One, you know, to the point in the piece about people being scared to be critical and being soft, I like the confrontational element of this. You know, if you're coming, if, say, she writes a review that's not entirely positive, and suddenly they're face to face, that's exciting from the beginning. and they're going to have a different tenored conversation than if she goes in and does some, you know, adoration profile type piece and,
sure,
and asks all the questions we've seen before. On the flip side, I think one of the least interesting things ever is creators defending themselves, whether it's whether it's art or, you know, Kanye West. Well, he can be entertaining when doing it, but also really
right,
not fun to listen
or
to.
Or some friend who asks you to read an article and then doesn't really want your feedback.
Yeah, exactly. So, in, you know, that conversation to me is rarely going to go in an interesting direction. And I think that, you know, I'd like to know what Marco thinks, but I think... Well, maybe interesting is the wrong word, but I don't know that we need to hear it. But I think I'm interested to hear what you think, Marco, sure, that we have so many platforms now for chefs to tell their story, to tell their point of view. So do we need it after the review in that sort of setting?
Right.
And I should just add, she's not it's not a prerequisite that they come on and litigate the review,
right,
but they're welcome to do that. So
listen, I think what she's doing is ballsy and needed and a great thing. I think that, you know, it's nice for a critic to be critiqued because it maybe gives them a level of empathy that they otherwise wouldn't have. I think that I would love the opportunity, you know, I would love the opportunity to have that conversation after some of the reviews I've gotten in my career. Because
can't we just do a boxing match?
I don't know. I think there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of valid questions that could be asked. I look back and think about, you know, my reviews at NCMA back in the day or my original review at Hearth. And I think that there are legitimate, interesting conversations and questions that could be posed that aren't just, you know, chefs being little whiny bitches about why didn't, you know, you don't understand food kind of concept. Like, I think you're underestimating kind of, you know, our ability to kind of look at things from an outsider's perspective and come up with insightful questions. And now that I know about this, I'm going to really go there and see what these conversations are like. I really find it compelling,
yeah,
I mean, and interesting.
For me, what I think is interesting, and again, it's this whole notion. I think if I've never been a critic, I couldn't be a critic, I don't think. You know, that line between criticism and derision, I feel like if I were someone who was inclined to sort of the, you know, the zinger, this would maybe keep me from going there. It would maybe keep my reviews at sort of a level of almost reportage, like maybe, you know, having to say this place really isn't good, but without taking it to a certain level that I think it becomes very different when you're face-to-face with somebody. You know, it's a social media phenomenon, right? I mean, a lot of people say things on Twitter and then they find themselves at an opening or some event with somebody they said it about, and they're sort of like going to great pains to, you know, be on the opposite side of the room. Marco, just quickly, because we're toward the end of the show, you just recently revamped the menu at Hearth.
I did.
It incorporates some more healthful elements based on kind of a change you went through,
yep,
in your own life that's been written about, kind
mm-hmm.
of not unusual for a chef, the way you were living. You've been very open about it.
All.
A lot of alcohol, a lot of Marlboros,
yep,
all of this. But can you just, again, I apologize that we're down to the wire here, but I'm just curious, you know, as you've changed the menu, what's kind of the reaction been at the restaurant, and what kind of feedback are you getting at Hearth?
We've been getting amazing feedback, and a lot of people are incredibly supportive and very happy that I'm kind of going out there and saying the things I'm saying. Like, I think that there's a new, you know, there's a sea change happening out there that I haven't seen in many, many years. I think that if you ever said the word healthy 10 years ago, it would be like the nail in your coffin of your restaurant. And I love the fact that, you know, the conversation about food as nourishment is coming back around. And this idea of, you know, value is not from a big pile of cheap food, but I believe value comes from serving nutrient-dense, nourishing food. And I think it's really nice that the time has come that people are asking more from their food than, you know, sticky, salty, tasty, and they want it to do things. And you know, people want to feel good after their meal, not regretful after their meal. And I think that you could have that and feel decadent at the same time. And that's kind of our mission, right? It's like I'm trying to prove to people that healthy, real, nourishing, nutrient-dense food that makes you feel good, served in the proper portion size, can feel decadent, and it might be the one place you want to go on a Saturday night, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. We had a whole big talk last week about pressure in the kitchen and how the culture of the kitchen has kind of evolved away from kind of the screaming saute pan throwing, you know, chef, that's kind of not as accepted ones as it used to be. And, you know, the old joke used to be, why doesn't my food at home taste like restaurant food? And it's because, you know, the answer was you're using about a third as much butter and salt. You know, like that was kind of like what chefs would talk about privately.
Sure.
But now, you know, there's this whole group of you guys that are really kind of embracing things that have happened to you for personal reasons,
right,
in your restaurants.
Well, yeah, and there's also, my God, in the world of nutrition, there's so much conflict out there that, you know, this notion of low fat being healthy is, you know, a real problem. And, you know, we're using plenty of butter and we're using plenty of fat and we're using really good meats. And I think part of the problem with the term healthy is that everybody has a different kind of notion of what healthy is. And I think we have to use a different word because that word has just been mangled and beaten up for so long that it doesn't really hold any meaning.
Right.
You know, I like the term real food. I think that says a lot. I think one of the things we're trying to do at Hearth is like, you know, if we're going to source the perfect pig, then I shouldn't feel comfortable buying a big 100-pound bag of commodity big food sugar, right?
Sure.
And that, you know, processed foods and big food foods happen across the board. It's not just going to the local green market to buy a carrot or getting a good pig, but there's a lot of other things we're buying. And I really wanted to kind of like broaden the kind of overused farm-to-table approach.
Great. Thank you. And all this is summed up quite neatly in a what do you call it, an infographic,
yes,
on the Hearth website, if anyone wants to go there. Well, with that, thank you all for being here. I just want to quickly mention there is a discount available for listeners of Heritage Radio Network at Bitten, a food conversation, which is a conference happening tomorrow, Friday, February 12th. It runs all day from 8:15 a.m. to 5 p.m. If you go to thisisbitten.com and use the code HRN30, it's a 30% discount for that conference, which is substantial. Also, remind everybody, we have our new Twitter handle, at Chef Podcast, and Facebook page, The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. And again, we would just love some iTunes reviews. I know that's shameless. We won't keep doing that every week. We would like to... this is hugely important. Liz Smith, our producer, it's her last day. Hi, Liz. She's looking at us through the glass. Liz got us through our first, now, 6 shows, Jimmy.
Yes.
And she's been just awesome.
Made Superstar.
Made us feel very calm. Managed a lot of last-minute stuff for us and has just been great, so we thank her for that. We're going to miss you, Liz. Thanks to our guests, Chris Schomburger, Max Falkowitz, Chef Marco Canora. For The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, I'm Andrew Friedman.
I'm Jimmy Bradley.
And we will see you back next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.